This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Dr. Ronald Mason, Jr. He is the president of the Southern University System, and he has been in the news of late with some issues regarding faculty. He'll talk about that and much more pertaining to the school on the bluff, Southern University, which at one time was the nation's largest historically black university. We'll talk with Dr. Mason about everything happening that pertains to the Jaguars in Baton Rouge and beyond. Also on the show, Kevin Kwan. His book is Crazy Rich Asians, a novel that Vanity Fair calls like Dynasty on steroids, with more private jets, bigger houses, and a lot more money. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757 toll-free, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, or tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest is Dr. Ronald Mason, starting year number 5 as president of Southern University. Previously, he was at Jackson State for a decade and spent 18 years at Tulane, so he knows this area quite well. Graduate of Columbia University. How many degrees from Columbia?
Bachelor's and law degree.
Bachelor's and law degree from the university that is the alma mater of the President of the United States, who is turning 53 years old today. Happy birthday to President Barack Obama. And with school about to start, there's some friction on campus with you and some faculty members. What's going on?
Well, this is a challenging time in the history of Southern University system. And it's no secret that our Baton Rouge campus has had, particular challenges with budget cuts, inability to balance the budget, loss of enrollment, and this year we couldn't raise tuition because of not meeting benchmarks on the Grad Act. It requires some radical intervention, in my opinion, and there is a small but very, very vocal group who has consistently been, I would say, against the kinds of changes that we've been trying to implement. Or at least on occasion, they get these headlines like was in yesterday, Sunday's paper. And people get the impression that this is a mass movement speaking here, but it's really a few people making a good bit of noise. And, just coincidentally this morning, Jim, I mentioned to you, I got an email, copied on an email that I think kind of puts it all in perspective. If I could read it to you, I'd appreciate that opportunity.
Okay, and before you do that, I'll read the first two graphs of yesterday's story by Elizabeth Crisp in The Advocate. Mm-hmm. She writes, Southern University faculty Senate leaders say their problems with System President Ron Mason are past the point of resolving through a sit-down meeting. The bitter feud between Mason and some Southern University faculty members has continued to bubble over following a unanimous faculty senate vote of no confidence and push for Mason's ouster. It remains to be seen if or how the issues can be resolved. So some strong words yesterday in The Advocate, and Dr. Mason says he has an update that has occurred within the last few minutes.
Yeah, and before I read this email that I got copied on, which I really do think puts it in perspective, understand that I am by bylaw a member of all of the faculties of every unit within the system, and the Senate at the Baton Rouge campus has these meetings, which I am the topic of conversation, but I never get invited to the meetings. And, we told Elizabeth, and I think she put it in one of her stories when this happened, when people say things but don't give you an opportunity to respond to it, it's very difficult to get the truth on the table. And then as recently as last week, we invited, it's really three people, to open forums to air out what they were saying in public, allow me a time to respond and put the truth on the table. They declined the public invitation. And then Preston Castile, who many know is a respected attorney in town and just got elected as the president of our Alumni Federation, National Federation, offered to sort of sit with us and sort through whatever these misunderstandings and issues might be. They declined that invitation, and now we sort of are where we are. But if I could read this email, I think it would put it in some context for you, because this was something that just popped up in my email this morning from William Moore, who was a retired faculty member, was actually the founding president of the alumni of the faculty senate, right? And it's short, but let me just read it to you, and I think it really does put it into context. He says the faculty senate as a represent. This is to one of my board members, Myron Lawson, and I was copied on it apparently. The faculty senate as a representative group is almost non-existent. This body is supposed to consist of more than 30 members, but it is denigrated to 13. This means that a large segment of the university is not represented. In addition, there is no avenue for input from the faculty. The effect is that we have three people claiming to be an executive committee, but when their actions reach the press, it leaves the reader with the impression of a faculty vote of no confidence. I am troubled by this state of affairs because 41 years ago, we devoted an extraordinary amount of energy to create a body that was respected by faculty as well as the administration and board. This present group is out of control and is potentially hoodwinking the press and public in general. I am recommending that the board do some investigating, especially if it is inclined to listen to this group. Sincerely, William E. Moore, founding faculty senate president, retired distinguished professor of chemistry. And I don't think I could have put it any better. I mean, it is a small but vocal group that gets a disproportionate amount of attention and really distracts some serious conversation away from the things we should be talking about, which is how to balance the budget, how to organize the campus, and how to reposition Southern to be competitive in a highly competitive environment.
297-5633 is your number, and we will go to the phone lines for Dr. Ronald Mason, Southern University president, starting his fifth year under a cloud with a vote of no confidence from the faculty senate, but he says this is a group that includes 13 members of the faculty and three who are the leaders, and Mr. Miller, who is the president, he is quoted in yesterday's paper saying previous attempts to meet with you have been rebuffed. He is quoted as saying, Dr. Mason, this pretense that his office has always been open is just a load of malarkey. Is he telling the truth?
You want to speak up?
Yeah.
Well, it's just not a load of malarkey. I mean, I read all my own emails and I respond to them. We've offered on several occasions to have Mr. Miller and the leadership join us in my office to talk through some issues. No response. In fact, just as recently as 3 weeks ago, I reached out. Dr. Miller came to my office. We had a meeting mm-hmm. and started to talk through some of the issues because I found out that there was a proposed reorganization at a board meeting that got to be pretty controversial. And Dr. Miller and I actually agreed on the fact that it was a bad idea. But I found out that we disagreed, or at least he disagreed because he thought it was my idea when it really wasn't. It was proposed by one of our board members. So I reached out on the grounds that maybe we had some common ground, and we had a meeting in my office with the expectation that we'd follow up. And then the next day they had this press conference that was in the newspaper calling for my ouster or something like that. So it's that sort of thing going on. I meet with the deans on a regular basis. I meet with the chancellors on a regular basis. We've had open forums around the state. So we're pretty transparent and open administration. And there's not any questions that we're asked that we won't answer directly and in public. But you gotta play fair. You know, you have to give people an opportunity to stand up and respond when you have things that you are saying that, you know, are worthy of a response but you don't want to hear it.
Well, the Southern campus now has about 6,500 students. That's down from 9,000. 13,000 total in the Southern University system, and the entire system is led by Dr. Ronald Mason. Well, what is the biggest sticking point with the Faculty Senate? Is there one issue?
It's unclear. You know, I think it's a classic challenge of change versus resistance to change. And, you know, there is a sort of an alliance among a group that just doesn't want the campus to change. And the truth is that it requires a great deal of change if it's going to not only survive but also thrive. We have a model in place that we think would work, much like what they're doing at LSU, except we're about a year ahead of them. At least we were a year ago, you know, to centralize back office operations. We put in a new online college. We've moved our community college from not only in Shreveport, but also on the four-year campuses. You know, it's a good plan. I mean, it's a good plan and it's state of the art, and we're going to redo our academic programs to be more tied to the workforce. The problem, though, is that we get the structures and the ideas approved, but when it comes time to moving people around, that's been the challenge. And, you know, I think we're fighting against a culture of relationships as opposed to performance, which is part of the history of the institution. And, you know, when you start to get in the middle of relationships that have been there for a very long time, you run into resistance. And I think that's part of what's going on.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, if you'd like to talk with Dr. Ronald Mason, certainly an articulate ambassador for Southern University. Times have been tough. Recently, the chancellor, Jim Lorenz, was let go as his contract expired at the end of June. Before we go to our first caller, were you behind Lorenz's departure or not?
Well, if you say behind it, do you mean that I agree with it? Well, my job was to make a recommendation, an evaluation and recommendation, which I did. And my recommendation was actually that Dr. Lorenz's contract be extended for a year with some conditions, though. And the conditions were basically that, you know, we be allowed as a system to go in, identify the challenges that had been intractable, just hadn't been addressed over the course of 3 years, and make some recommendations to the board on how to fix that. Dr. Lorenz thought that was an infringement upon the authority of the chancellor. And once that conversation sort of got started, then board politics got involved. And in the end, as you know, it was not a pretty sight. But the board ended up voting not to accept my recommendation.
Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air with Dr. Mason.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning, Dr. Mason. Dr. Mason, like you, I've had the experience of graduating from an Ivy League institution, little Harvard University up there, but I'm also a graduate of Southern University. And I think perhaps that may be part of the problem, Dr. Mason, is that you don't have that HBCU experience. I'd like to hear you comment on that. My second question is, how do you justify a salary like yours at a small HBCU compared to, let's say, an LSU? How do you justify a salary of $500,000 a year when faculty members are getting courses cut and making as little as $2,100 for a summer term?
Yeah, well, that's a fair question. I'll give you a couple of answers. One, you know, I didn't go to an HBCU, you know, I've lived in black neighborhoods and with a black family all my life because I'm African-American. As you know, I spent 10 years at Jackson State. What I didn't know about an HBCU culture, I certainly learned over the course of those 10 years. In fact, you know, I'm on the president's advisory committee on historically black colleges and universities. I'm on the board of the Thurgood Marshall College Fund, which represents all of the state institutions of higher learning. You know, I'm a national spokesperson and advocate for historically black colleges and universities, not only because I believe they're important institutions for America, but also because they're under great threat right now. And, you know, if we don't find a way to adjust to this new reality in higher education in general, historically black universities in particular, you know, we're going to have real challenges going forward. Now, as for my salary, you know, that was a necessity of coming to Southern, candidly. They recruited me to come. I was not looking to leave Jackson. I knew it was a difficult situation. I knew that from a career point of view, it had a lot of risk involved. And, you know, we negotiated a salary that, you know, given the challenges, I thought, you know, was fair. You know, I've been at a high level of higher administration for quite a long time. So that, you know, it was a business decision, and it was the Southern's choice to pay me that to bring me here.
297-5633. We'll return to Dr. Ronald Mason, who's taking all Cumbers today. If you want to talk to him, this is an opportunity. Wherever you are, 877-217-5757, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Frank Barnett is producing, and our guest for a while longer is the president for the last 4 years, now going on five, Dr. Ronald Mason from Southern University. Dr. Mason is right now at odds with some members of his faculty, in particular the leaders of the Faculty Senate. And Frank, I think, tells me that Dr. Miller, who we referenced, has called in. Dr. Miller, good morning. Thomas Miller, you're on with Dr. Mason. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Good morning, President Mason. Good morning, Mr. Inkster. How are you all this morning?
Fine.
Good. Thank you.
Good. Listen, there are so many things that were said in the opening moments that are not quite on base. I don't know where to begin. But let me just start with this. When Mr. Mason, President Mason, left Jackson State, he left under a cloud. There was a vote of no confidence, also unanimous.
All right. Well, let's talk about what's going on at Southern.
Okay. Well, for one thing, let's talk about the representation of faculty in the Faculty Senate. Now, there was a recent election. I was reelected along with members of our executive committee. And the 70% of the faculty came out to vote. The margin, we were at 61% for myself and the vice president versus 39% for our challengers. We have regular meetings scheduled during the year. The announcement is sent out publicly. Anyone who wants to attend is free to attend. Now, let me reference just one point. There's so many that I really don't know where to begin, but this idea that President Mason's office is open and welcoming to faculty. Let me just give you three instances.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Hold on. We're going to let you talk, Thomas, Dr. Miller, but I'd like for Dr. Mason to have a chance to respond because you're giving him a lot to work with, and so much so that I'm not sure he'd be able to respond to everything you're saying if we let you continue unabated. But Dr. Mason, your thoughts about the initial statements from Dr. Miller.
Well, sure. Just to be clear, what I said about who the Faculty Senate is and what it represents wasn't me saying it. I was reading an email from Dr. Moore, who was the founding president of the Faculty Senate and who is a, I think, well-respected former chemistry professor. So I don't really have any independent information to verify how many faculty voted and who didn't vote and who's at the meetings, who's not at the meetings. I was simply reading the email, and that was thought a timely email, and I passed it on to the public.
All right. Dr. Miller, please continue.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Well, as far as access to his office, let me just give you three examples. Jim Lorenz's contract was the board voted not to extend it on a Friday afternoon sometime, I think it was, in late. I believe it was late February. So the following Monday, I went to the president's office, spoke with his chief of staff, Mrs. Ola Bates, and said I'd like to meet with the president to discuss how we go forward as a system in the university. Ms. Bates said, there's an opening at 2:30 this afternoon. Do you think you could make it? And I said, yes, ma'am, I'll be there. I walked back across campus to my office, and when I opened my email, there was an email from Mason staff saying that the president will not be available until, I believe it was March 15th in the email, 3 weeks before he could speak with me. Now, there was a chancellor search that was put together. There was no consultation with the Faculty Senate. So I emailed and I called and I said there should be consultation with the Faculty Senate when you have a committee getting together to search for a new chancellor. And what his chief of staff told me was that this SUBR Faculty Senate will not be included in the search because we don't want to politicize the situation.
All right, Dr. Mason.
Factually, Dr. Miller's right about the meeting. My chief of staff did say we would be able to do it that afternoon. Something came up, I don't remember what it was, and I couldn't make the meeting that afternoon. And, you know, how soon after that the meeting was scheduled, I really don't remember. It could have been 2 weeks. I don't know. But, you know, I travel a lot. I'm a busy guy, but it's not like we did not want to meet. And then on the Senate piece, he's factually accurate again. We didn't have any institutional representatives on this search committee because I've seen how politicized these processes can be. We didn't have a representative from the staff Senate. We didn't have a representative from the faculty Senate. We didn't have a representative from the foundation. And even the student we picked, we randomly identified the student who had the highest GPA in the junior class and asked her to serve on the committee. So it was a conscious attempt to keep institutional representatives, but we did have representatives from the colleges and even deans on the search committee. We just didn't have institutional representatives there. So he's factually accurate, more or less, in both cases.
Do you think there's any way to resolve the differences with Dr. Miller and others?
Look, my door is open. Mr. Castile has offered to sit with us. I'm ready, willing, and able. I wouldn't have made the offer and the invitation if I had not been willing to and sincere about it, because it's important for the future of Southern. I mean, if the parties who have an interest in Southern can't sit down and try to find some middle ground, then it's going to be very difficult to move the institution forward, and I'm fully aware of that.
Do you feel like you have the support of the Board of Supervisors?
It's difficult to say, I'll be honest with you, because the change process and resistance to change that's playing out on the campus is also playing out on the Board of Supervisors. And some days I feel like, they get it. Some days I feel like, the resistance to change is overwhelming even for them. So I could not tell you in the long run how that works out.
How long does your contract run?
This is my last year.
So the board will have to make a call on that. You'd like to stay?
I'd like to finish the work. I do believe in HBCUs. I think that there are two really special HBCUs in America. One is Howard University, because they get a very large federal subsidy from the federal government, which distinguishes them. And I think the second is Southern, because Southern is the only system, HBCU system, in America. And in this rapidly changing time, being a system gives you opportunities to do things and adjust to this new reality that individual institutions cannot do. So sure, I'd like to see it through, because I think it's important work.
All right. You have talked about the Southern brand and how it's been affected by this. It can't be a good thing.
Well, no, it's not. But you know, there are good things within the conversation as well. I mean, everybody knows about our School of Nursing. Everybody knows about the great work that our community college is doing. The work that we're doing with the community college in New Orleans and in Baton Rouge is proven to be a real winner. And even the online college, what we're struggling with because of operational issues, you know, the slowness of our processing systems. But even that, I think, in the long run, is going to reposition Southern to provide some leadership. But there are other things that involve moving people around that we just have to pull the trigger on, and that always gets to be where the challenge is in a change process.
Now, as I mentioned, half the students at the Southern system go to school in other places. Is it 13,000, isn't that correct, overall? Mm-hmm. 6,500 on the Baton Rouge campus. How do you consolidate, or is that a good thing?
Well, we're not talking about consolidating in the sense of removing the individual identities of the other schools. I mean, the SUNO will always be a fully accredited, historically black college and university. So will the law school, and so will the Shreveport campus, right? But what we're talking about is taking advantage of the fact that we're a system in ways that we can. For example, back office operations. You don't need 5 IT departments. You don't need 5 human resources. You don't need 5 accounting offices. And the irony for us is that the board has approved the new structure, the new salaries, the new job descriptions, the new organizational chart. But when it came to moving the people into the new structure, that's where we broke down. And we haven't been able to do that last step yet. Enabling students who can't get into our 4-year schools because of the new admissions requirements, now they can get in through the community college on the 4-year campuses and easily transition into a 4-year degree. But you have to have an inventory of academic programs across the whole system to be able to make that work. So there are things we can do because we're a system that I think can really distinguish us from the pack and even provide some leadership for higher education in Louisiana and in the rest of the country.
What has been the principal reason for the decline in enrollment?
Well, it's several things. One is the budget cuts. I mean, these budget cuts have done real damage, not only for higher education in general, but for Southern in particular. Because, you know, historically, black universities are basically institutional reflections of black people in America. And the thing about black people is that they've never had access to wealth or the ability to generate wealth, just as the way the country's set up. And it's the same that's true with historically black colleges and universities, and the lack of wealth over time takes a toll. So that when these big budget cuts come, we don't have the ability to ride them out. You know, we don't have an athletic foundation that can give us $7 million a year or whatever LSU's athletic foundation did to allow it to ride out these cuts. So systems start to suffer. You have less people doing more work, those sorts of things. But then the other piece is that, you know, in Louisiana, we're a very political place. Baton Rouge is a very political place. And you know, politics takes its toll over time. And then when you have these budget cuts then the inefficiencies of politics in the management of an institution start to show. So in some cases, you have people who are there because of who they know and not what they know. And that's the case, I'm sure, with LSU as well. But LSU can hide it. We just can't hide it when these tight times come through. So it becomes a culture of relationships as opposed to performance when you have to perform at your highest level. And then finally, it's just a really, really competitive environment, and you got to have your A game. If you look at schools like Baton Rouge Community College, LSU, and University of Louisiana Lafayette, you know, their enrollment is generally flat, but they're losing white students. And the way that they're keeping their enrollment up is because their black student population is going up. And in a lot of ways, the students that we're losing are the ones that they're picking up. And it's because we just haven't had our A game in the last few years.
The community college, it hasn't been around that long. And it would seem that that is where many of the students that would ordinarily be going to Southern are congregating now. Is that a valid assessment?
Well, partially, I'd say. I would say we're losing some students to community college, but on the other hand, you know, we've by having our community college in Baton Rouge now, we picked up about 600 students that came in directly through our community college that would not have been able to get into Southern Baton Rouge because of the admission standards. Mm-hmm. But I also think you know, we're losing some to the other four-year schools. At least it would appear that way, just watching the numbers. But understand this, Jim, the state is making a conscious effort to push more students into community college through a combination of driving up costs as well as increasing admission standards. And I think the thinking is that because of these jobs that are coming into the state, you know, in the short run, we really need welders and electricians and construction workers to in the early stages of this process. So that you're going to see more students going to community college because they don't have a whole lot of choice. The challenge, I think, is getting them through community college and then into a four-year degree, because ultimately the question is, do we want Louisiana to be a four-year degree type institution that runs the plants, or a two-year degree or a training program type institution that works with the people who come in from out of the state and run the plants?
I've commented on this program a few times that the Southern Law Center is the most integrated educational place in our state. Blacks and whites, I think about equal numbers, are at that school, and it is, of course, an outstanding law center. Rick Causey writes, I suggest that Southern and similar schools make an effort to attract people of all cultural backgrounds and perhaps gradually stop placing an emphasis on the historical reference. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, the irony is that historically black universities are the only universities that never kept anybody out.
That's true.
And we've always been open to everyone. I think the history is what it is, and I don't know that the historical reference necessarily discourages other people from coming to historically black universities. I believe in the case of Southern, There's nothing wrong with us holding on to, you know, the fundamentals of our mission, which is to serve the underserved. On the other hand, in Louisiana, there's a lot of underserved people, whether they're white or black or Hispanic or Indian, for that matter. And I think that if we can move the institution to this new model to become a 21st century product, for lack of a better way to put it, I think it will be attractive to a lot of people. And I think ultimately, you know, it's the quality of the product and the value of the degree that attract students to your institution, not whether or not you're historically white, historically black, or historically Hispanic.
Well, and you make a valid point that Southern University was the only place where black kids could go for a long time. So the fact that it is a historically black university is a matter of fact.
It's just a fact. And the fact that Howard is an historically, not Howard, Harvard, is an historically white university is just a matter of fact. But that doesn't mean that black students won't go to Harvard, and I don't think it means that white students won't go to Southern. In fact, the law school proves the point. It's about 50-50. It's one of the most popular and one of the most diverse law schools in the country. But it is an historically black law school.
It is.
Yeah.
But recently, maybe not so recently, the DA is a graduate of that school, former governor. And the mayor.
And several legislators.
And yeah. Several legislators. And you have a night program there that enables people who work to pursue a degree while they're not working. And it is a great institution. What are some of the more prominent entities you have at the university as a whole as far as individual departments?
Sure. Well, you know about, everybody knows about the nursing school, which has been top school in the state, I think, 3 out of the last 4 years. The engineering programs are still very solid. Took a tour of those facilities and programs about 2 weeks ago. And when there's several partnerships over there with industry members who are funding programs, funding laboratories, those sorts of things. Computer science is about to enter into a new partnership with the Department of Economic Development. And industry and the IBM, you know, the IBM work that's going on, and I think that's going to be moving forward in a very rapid fashion. In New Orleans, rebuilding the entire campus down there from scratch is starting to look better and better. Forensics, the business school got fully accredited the first time out of the gate, which is really extraordinary. We're looking for great things from Southern New Orleans, which is an undergraduate workhorse down in New Orleans. You know, our ag work, which is based in Baton Rouge, but does work with underserved people all over the state, is really filling a gap that needs to be filled in terms of services for the underserved. And then our community college, I think, is going to be the key to the future for the system. That is where the market's going to be. It's always been a high performer. Even though it had some grad ac issues this time around, that was not because they failed anything. It was because their performance level was so high when they set the benchmarks that it was hard for them to keep up with themselves. So that now, even though technically they've so-called failed the grad ac, they're still performing as good as or better as every other community college in the state. That's one of the ironies of the grad ac.
There you go. 297-5633, 877-217-5757. We'll spend a few more minutes with Dr. Ronald Mason, the president of Southern University, back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633, your number, outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. Dr. Ronald Mason coming up on year 5, which he says is the last year of his contract at Southern University, and the Board of Supervisors, in its wisdom, will determine whether Dr. Mason has a new contract. A question from a listener, Kevin, he wants to know if you think Southern should replicate what LSU has done and make the president and the chancellor the same position.
Yeah, I've already advised my board that even though early on I did not like the idea for a lot of different reasons, I think that when you combine the positions, both the flagship campus and the other institutions are at risk of not having enough attention paid to their campuses. But I've also advised my board that, you know, given the realities of our budget situation this year, I think it's an unavoidable path, an unavoidable course, and I've actually recommended to them, and will be recommending to them, that as a way to balance the budget, we combine the two positions. Can I mention one other thing while I got you here?
Certainly.
I just got a text from my communications guy. He reminded me on this open door issue that every other month I actually have an open door day on each campus where anybody from any part of the institution can schedule time to just come and sit with and talk with me about anything that's on their mind. He wanted me to say that because, you know, in some ways, I go through extraordinary lengths to have an open door so that anybody can come to me and say what they have to say.
All right. Charlotte in Iberia Parish. Charlotte, you're on the air with President Mason. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, Jim. Hi, President Mason.
Hi, Charlotte.
I'm calling to ask whether the Southern University system can accommodate students who may start off learning carpentry and the general skills and then eventually want to become an architect or a structural engineer. And
yes.
I'll listen to the answer off the air. Thank you.
Yes, I think that's a great question. And here is what we're trying to accomplish at Southern, because we are a system, and that gives us a chance to do things we couldn't normally do, wouldn't otherwise be able to do. But our thought is that anyone that walks into the door at Southern should have a path to success, whatever that means for the student walking in the door. So in your case, for example, a student could start out in the community college in a training program. That training program could lead to an associate's degree. That associate's degree could lead to a bachelor's degree. And the actual areas that you discussed are great examples. You start in construction, then you go to construction management, and then you can transition into civil engineering. That's a doable proposition, and it's the kind of thing that you can do in the new Southern that we're trying to create, whether you're in New Orleans, in Shreveport, or in Baton Rouge, or some combination of the three. And by the time it's all said and done, you'll be able to do a lot of it online as well. So that's a great question, and it gave me a great opportunity to talk about the vision for the future.
Carmen on I-12. Hi, Carmen. You're on with President Mason.
Hi, President Mason. I am an undergraduate and a graduate of Southern University, and I also work at the Board of Regents. I just wonder why does Southern have the Ag Center with a chancellor? I think that's another duplication of effort at their university.
LSU has now...
It's just combined, yes. And you know, we watch LSU closely, and be honest with you, they watch us closely. We all watch each other for ideas about how to deal with this new reality. You know, that was something that was not always there at Southern. Actually, the Ag Center was a part of the Ag College, and then I think it was in the 90s they divided them, and there's some conversation now about putting them back together. Of course, the Ag Center does not think it's a good idea, and the Ag College thinks it's a good idea, and that conversation is going on as we speak, and it's not clear how it's going to end up, but it is a good question, and it's been a real engaged conversation.
Albert Samuels writes to you, and of course he is one of the faculty senate leaders who has led the charge against Dr. Mason. He says, we understand very well your agenda, and we have rejected it. You have consistently misconstrued the problems of our university. Southern University does not have an organizational structure problem. It has an enrollment problem.
Well, yeah. It does have an enrollment problem, and the enrollment problem leads to financial problems, and the financial problems are structural in the sense that the campus is spending more money than it takes in every year, and the numbers just don't lie. You know, pick whatever structure you want to, but the structure has to be one that enables the campus to get better. This notion of combining the president and chancellor, or let me put it differently. This notion of having one administration that runs both the system and the Baton Rouge campus is one that at this stage is just dollar driven. You know, it's a $2 million savings if you do that. And when you're looking at a major structural deficit, it's something that you have to consider. Ultimately, it's in the hands of the board. And I know that Dr. Samuels and Miller and Bagayoko disagree with the plan that we put on the table. I guess the challenge for me is that I haven't heard any other plans, you know, other than to do what we've been doing the way we've been doing it and expect a different result. And, of course, you know, that hasn't worked for us in the past, and there's no reason for me to think, at least, that it will work for the future.
Now, independent of whether you like Dr. Mason or not, I think all of us could agree that being head of a university, any university in this state over the last 6 years, has been heavy lifting. The budgets have been cut. That's a philosophy our governor has taken in response to budget issues. Rather than seeking new revenue, he has made cuts primarily to higher education. So with that as the backdrop, what's the environment for your cohorts around the state right now?
It's very challenging. You know, I meet with Dr. Woodley and Dr. Alexander and Monty on a regular basis, and we talk about it a lot. You know, for the bigger systems like U of L, it varies depending on the school within the system, and some have greater challenges than others. The community college challenge is that they're growing leaps and bounds, and state funding's not able to keep up with them without further cutting the other areas of higher education, which is always going to bring some tension to the table. And even LSU, you know, which is the flagship. And, you know, as battleships in the fleet, we understand the need for the flagship. You know, within Louisiana, they're feeling less of the pain, but in comparison to those with whom they compete, you know, they have their challenges as well. So it's going to be a difficult thing to navigate, primarily because, you know, it's an odd thing going on here. I mean, the job side of the economy is growing leaps and bounds. But in order to do that, we've sort of bifurcated the economy so that the revenue coming into the state is not mm-hmm. keeping up with it. And the problem for higher education is that it's the revenue coming into the state that funds higher education. So you have this sort of perplexing situation where the workforce producer for the state, at a time when the state needs workforce produced in very large numbers, is looking at a situation where it's not clear where the funding to fund the workforce producers is going to come from, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah. What are the odds you'll be president of Southern University a year from now?
You know, it is not in my hands. You know, and I sort of described, I was just on a panel that talked about board president relationships, right? Because it's a challenge around the country, especially at HBCUs. I think in the last 18 months, somebody told me something like 38 HBCU presidents have either resigned, retired, or been terminated, right? So it's a volatile environment with high expectations and few resources to meet those expectations, right? So what I said was that, you know, I think the work at Southern is good work. I think the business community gets it and understands it. I think the Board of Regents gets it and understands it. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that at least 7 members of my board gets it and understands it. The problem is it takes 9 votes to move the agenda, to keep the president or get rid of the president. And in the end, you know, the fate of the institution is in the hand of the board. And if they want me to play a role, I will. And if they don't, I did the best I could with the time I had to work with.
Well, we thank you for joining us and appreciate your candor. And Baton Rouge, despite the problems that have been apparent in higher education funding over the last 6 years, Baton Rouge is the only, as Mike Martin used to say, the only city in America with 2 land-grant universities in the same city.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr.
Both doing good work.
Yeah. So let's talk soon.
All right, Jim.
Appreciate it. We're joined now by Kevin Kwan. His book is Crazy Rich Asians, now in paperback, and a book that got outstanding notices when it was first available in hardback, and a nice review in the New York Times from Janet Maslin, who sometimes is a tough reviewer. Kevin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And as I noted, Vanity Fair refers to your book is like Dynasty on steroids, more private jets, bigger houses, and a lot more money.
Yeah, it's also been called the Downton Abbey of Asia. So it's funny all the comparisons people have been making ever since the book first came out last year.
Well, Kevin was born and raised in Singapore. He lives in Manhattan, and this is his first novel. But as a novel, it is based on true experience, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, the whole reason I began to write this book was because, you know, living in suburban Houston from the age of 12, I wasn't really exposed to what was going on to the incredible boom that was happening in Asia. So when I first started visiting Asia again in the early 90s, it was absolutely astounding to me, some of the things I would see, you know, people living in $40, $50 million homes, you know, people flying around in private jets like they were chartering buses, things like that. So I felt like this world really needed to be exposed and really treated sensitively and shown from a personal perspective.
Well, are Asians more pretentious than others?
I wouldn't say so. I think it really depends on what sort of Asians you're talking about, and that's a very important distinction I make in my book, because my book is really about the clash between the old money overseas Chinese. These are the people that have lived in Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, you know, over the last century, versus the mainland Chinese, who have only become wealthy in the past 10 years or so. And yes, you know, with the mainlanders, because the money is so new, they really want to glorify it by spending and showing it off. But are they any more show-offy than the Russians were a decade ago, or even the Americans were back in the 1920s and 30s? I don't know.
What are some of the examples of excesses that you noted in places across the globe?
I think, first of all, the obsession with luxury labels. I've personally witnessed shopping sprees, you know, through Europe with people where they would spend, you know, a few million dollars in an afternoon just buying up all of Paris or buying up all of London. And, you know, of course, you know, weddings are where they really like to spend their money, and it's something that I satirize in my book with a very, very lavish wedding.
What's the most lavish wedding you?
The one I've heard of, the most lavish one I've come across, is a $140 million wedding that a mainland Chinese tycoon spent on his son. And it, you know, it consisted of a parade of 26 luxury cars through the town of this, you know, small Chinese city that they were in. And I think every guest got a car. Like, every guest was given a Lamborghini or Ferrari or something like that. So the auto procession alone, I'm told, cost something in the neighborhood of $17
million. A $140 million wedding. My goodness.
Exactly. It blows the mind, really.
We could resolve the problems of higher education for a year with that kind of money in Louisiana.
You're telling me.
Spend on one wedding. Well, is this is it an aberration, or is this the norm?
It will be very interesting to see. I think what's happening now is that the mainland Chinese, especially, they're making up for lost time. You know, they spent 50, 60 years living in very oppressive conditions. And now that they finally are starting to make their fortunes, you know, they're flexing their muscles a bit. They're really showing off, and they're enjoying their life. But as you see with the next wave, as you've seen in the past with the overseas Chinese who have mellowed out, you know, the money starts to become spent more on education, on philanthropy. You know, people get smart.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully this will be the trend.
What about houses? If your wedding's $140 million, what's the most expensive house that you have seen?
The most expensive house I've personally been to was in Hong Kong, and that was in the peak. And you have to remember that Hong Kong is a small island. So, you know, just like the island of Manhattan or the island of Singapore, you know, real estate, landed property will be at a premium. And so I would say the most expensive house I've been in personally was probably about $70
million. Just half as much as the wedding.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, this is by no means an extraordinarily large house. This is just, you know, I would say it was probably a 6 or 7 bedroom stately house, you know, on top of Hong Kong.
Right. Well, the book is Crazy Rich Asians, a novel based on historical evidence from Kevin Kwan. As a group, Asians who come to the United States, they've done very well. Why so?
I think it's a combination of factors. I think like any immigrant class that moves to the States or to moves to another country, the emphasis is on surviving, first of all. But with the Chinese, more than anything, they value education. And so you have families who have, you know, done everything in terms of investing in education for their children. And I think you've seen that pay off in the last 20, 30 years with way too many kids getting into Harvard who are of Asian descent. But, you know, it's really about the value system and then getting a great education, getting a great college degree, getting a good job. You know, those became the cornerstones of the immigrant life in America for Asians.
The book, Crazy Rich Asians, Janet Maslin says wickedly delectable, offers refreshing nouveau voyeurism to readers who long ago burned out on American and English aspirational fantasies. Hilarious. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. And we shall return tomorrow, same time, same place, and our guest will be the Mayor-President, Melvin Kip Holden. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.